Hello and welcome to another episode of the Aaron Crane Podcast. I am joined today by an attorney who I met through Provisors, and who I know I've mentioned him many times now on the show. It's a fantastic networking organization. And my guest today is an expert in business-related matters, right? All business attorney, from contract formation to disputes to acting as a registered agent. So I want you to meet Tim Johnston.
Thank you, Aaron. I really appreciate it. It's something I've been looking forward to, and I'm glad to be on the podcast.
Well, thanks for coming. Thanks for coming today. I know you're a busy guy, I'm sure, and I appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me. When I think about my legal career, and I enjoyed it, I think litigators have a really tough job. The clients don't ever want to talk to them, right? You do more. You're more hands-on with more fun stuff, I would say.
Well, I definitely do a lot of fun stuff, that's for sure. I focus my practice on representing small businesses, and these are businesses where sometimes you call them a mom and pop, sometimes you call them a family business, but these are, you know, 5, 10, 15 people organizations, and I help them with their day-to-day corporate maintenance or LLC maintenance duties. I help them with their contracts, and I also do help them in disputes. So sometimes, unfortunately, that does mean going to court. I do have a litigation background. I'm a former prosecutor.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I've also tried a number of civil cases, both juries and bench trials. And I do try probably 3 or 4 cases every year, unfortunately, have to go to trial. It's something we always try to avoid. 90, 95% of cases usually settle. And that is, of course, the goal. But if need be, absolutely, we go to court.
So you worked as a prosecutor. That sounds like an exciting job. Were you like the state's attorney's office?
That's correct. Yeah.
And what type of cases were you prosecuting?
Right. Well, so a lot of young attorneys right out of law school join the prosecutor's office. It's a great place to get trial experience, because often if you go to the private sector and do a larger firm, you don't get to see the inside of the courthouse, at least on meaningful matters, sure, right away in your career. But in the prosecutor's office, wherever you go, and the same is true for a public defender's office, you're in the courtroom in the first week, and you may be trying cases within a week or two of being there. It's always a team atmosphere with either of these organizations. And I would say it was the best job I ever had, because I'm there with a number of 20-something other attorneys. We're all on the same team. We're figuring it out as we go, and we're trying cases. And in about 2 years, I had about 30 or 35 cases that go to trial.
That experience is like incredibly valuable.
Incredibly. And you learn how to try a case on the fly. And that experience is translatable to civil litigation, even though, you know, in the criminal courtrooms, what I was trying initially, you start out with traffic cases. Mm-hmm. And those can be high speeding cases. They could be driving on license revoked, and they can certainly be the DUI cases.
Any of the stuff you learned, if you're getting pulled over and then you say to yourself, wow, this ticket will be thrown out because this cop made a mistake with an evidence, you say, he violated a rule of evidence, he'll never get it in. Do you ever think that way? Is it you using that to save your own butt?
Well, okay. So when you're on the side of the road with the cops, you should always be as polite and cooperative as possible.
Of course.
It doesn't matter what your opinion is.
That's true.
It matters what the police officer's opinion is, and then unfortunately the prosecutor, and then unfortunately the judge. So what you want to do is score as many points with that officer by being polite and cooperative without volunteering any information. Nothing you can say on the side of the road to a police officer can help you.
Right.
And in fact, what you say can only be used against you.
There you go. That's good advice.
And I'd like to expand on that
if you give me a moment. Of course.
If people need to understand this. So there's a rule against hearsay. Hearsay evidence is not admissible in court. Hearsay is the idea that somebody says something out of court, like, look at that guy, he did it, or that person must have been speeding, or that person was definitely at fault for this accident. Well, if you want to get that evidence in court, you should bring that person in who said it, and they can say it to the judge, and the other parties should be able to cross-examine that person. How well did you see the event that you claimed? Isn't it true that you are married to the other party? That person, their bias can be examined, and the credibility of their testimony can accurately be weighed. For these reasons, a hearsay statement, an out-of-court statement, is generally inadmissible. However, unfortunately, if you're the criminal defendant, there's a huge exception to the rule against hearsay, and that those are admissions. So admissions are a statement that the accused might make that would tend to make it more likely that they're guilty. And so if you say something that could hurt your case, well, that's an admission, and that's going to be admitted as an exception to the rule against hearsay. If you say something that helps your case, I didn't do it, somebody else did it, that will not be admitted. That will be excluded as inadmissible hearsay. And the only way to get that evidence in would be for the criminal defendant to take the stand against, you know, waiving their Fifth Amendment right, subjecting them to cross-examination. So the best practices are to be polite, cooperative, and say nothing.
If you're going to admit to something, mm-hmm. you probably did it, right? Isn't that sort of the idea behind why those statements are admissible and the others are on the other, if you have the other way, side of the coin, they're not?
That is the reasoning. However, I think that today we understand that that's not necessarily always the case. There is no more powerful foe to be in litigation against than the United States government or state of Illinois or whoever is prosecuting you. For the person who is, you know, has flashing lights behind them and an officer in their face, perhaps with the flashlight, it's terrifying. So perhaps that rationale is not as valid anymore. We've recognized that a lot of what are referred to as confessions
right.
should be judged with a lot of skepticism.
Do you find that like sort of how culture change and society changes, that the law is fast to change with it or there's a lag? You understand what I'm saying? Like, so the idea that confessions are, we're going to start scrutinizing them a little more and not just accepting them at face value, that there was a shift in the way we thought about human psyche and human interactions.
I would absolutely agree that there's a lag, that the law lags behind society. Society moves and the law follows. But right now on the national level, on the Supreme Court level, I don't know that it's fair to say that it's always in one direction. I think that there's a lot of political forces at play here.
Sure.
And I don't know that the reasoning that the law continues on a certain arc holds true anymore.
I mean, look, the country is going to be faced with an incredibly challenging issue with can a convicted felon, you know, run for president. Right? Think about it. It's an interesting argument or an interesting legal discussion. We don't have to get into it because that always ends up poorly. One way, the other side of the argument you're on, you're never a winner on that one.
So Couldn't agree more.
We can avoid that one. Back to you and talking about your role at the prosecutor's office and trying traffic tickets.
Yeah, it was absolutely a lot of fun. And in those cases, a lot of times what happens is your trial partner is on trial and their second case is now going to trial. And so you're handed the file. You're told to go to courtroom 402 and pick the jury. And you're finding out about the case on the fly.
Really?
And you're identifying your witnesses and thinking about your themes while you are asking jurors questions to determine if they can be fair jurors.
And that's got to be incredibly hard because each courtroom and each judge sort of has to handle civil procedure a little bit differently. And you have to figure it out quickly because, you know, those judges like to do it one way. It's either their way or the highway, right? I mean, it's their courtroom. They're in control, and this is the way they run the ship. I mean, that's incredibly intimidating. Then you're going to make a mistake. You're going to irritate the judge. Is that the things cross your mind when you're trying those cases?
All those things at every time, every moment. And that's the challenge, but that's why it's such a good learning experience. And that's why a lot of attorneys, even if they're not going to be criminal attorneys for the rest of their life, they go into these offices for that experience. The other thing that is part and parcel with this is learning to manage a docket of cases.
Sure.
As a prosecutor or as a public defender, you really don't have a control over your docket because cases come to you and it's up to you to determine which are the cases where we're going to be tough on, which are the cases where we're going to offer a sweet deal, which are the ones where even though the police officer thinks that the case is strong, do we just have to dismiss because we've identified a legal infirmity that is going to prevent us from going forward with the case? Prosecutorial discretion is key.
So, and when you're thinking about those cases, like maybe there's an issue that if you tried it would become an even bigger issue, right? And maybe, you know, the prosecutor's office doesn't want that attention or for whatever reason, you know, don't think it's appropriate to be bringing those cases that for whatever reason find some national attention or whatever, local attention, people start paying attention and making, asking questions.
Yeah.
Right.
We call those heater. Those are heater cases.
Yeah.
So in a heater case, that immediately goes up to the supervisors, perhaps even the elected official.
Wow.
And the line assistants, they follow the marching orders. But yeah, every couple months in a courtroom, there'll be somebody famous who got a DUI or is beating up their wife or whatever the case is. And you will see a supervisor on that case because that is absolutely a concern.
Yeah.
What I think is equally and probably more important is the ability of line assistants, meaning assistant state's attorneys, to have the discretion to say, well, this was a relatively small bag of drugs or a relatively minor thing that this person was caught doing, and they've demonstrated that they are. Perhaps this is an isolated incident. Perhaps they're recovering from something, or there's some extenuating circumstances. The best result is for those cases to be dropped by the prosecutor to keep that person out of the judicial system. There's alternatives called deferred prosecution, and those involve where a person accepts some form of responsibility, agrees to perform a certain set of tasks, stay out of trouble, usually do some service hours, maybe make a donation. And then at the end of a period of time, assuming they've complied with all that, the case is then dismissed. That's a great result. And you know, that's something that if you're polite and cooperative, is absolutely a possibility.
That's, you know, I was going to ask you then, the question is, what is that limit of drugs that you have to have on you where the prosecution will, and I'm just kidding, yeah. I'm just being silly, but
it's changing.
It changes. Because, you know, listen, when I was...
Law's changing.
When we were young, you know, pot was... That was a drug. It was bad. You know, you get caught with that, you're in trouble.
Class A misdemeanor, right. Punishable by up to a year in jail, $2,500 fine.
Look at that.
That's what it used to be. And that could be an eighth.
And today?
Well, it's very, very complicated now. So possession of cannabis is still illegal. However, there are exceptions to that rule. And if you qualify for those exceptions, then you are legal. However, there are exceptions to the exceptions. So...
Leave it up to lawyers to make it so complicated.
This is one of those questions where you ask a lawyer and the lawyer says it depends. But the answer is you can buy it if you are 21 and over from a licensed distributor or dispensary, and then you can bring it home to your home and in an unopened state. And then you can consume it in a private location. And what is a public location? What is a private location? That's an interesting question.
Okay.
Does it apply to your porch if you live in a dense urban area? Perhaps not. Does it apply to your car? Absolutely, you cannot do it in your car. It's still a basis for DUI, and people do get charged for DUI for this.
That's interesting because, you know, I walk around the Chicago these days, and I think everybody's smoking on their porch because it's crazy that people are
sure seems like
so
it.
Brazen. Because it's weird because, you know, when we're the same age.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we were probably products of Just Say No. That was I remember that being a very big deal when I was even in the '80s.
Mm-hmm.
And to see the shift of treatment of how, you know, how we view drugs and how we think of drugs is completely changed. And I still like, I can't believe it. Like in I live in Highland Park. It's a very nice conservative, you know, not conservative, but it's a very family values, family oriented. And there are dispensaries here. And it's if you told me that when I was in high school that one day they'd be selling pot, you know, I'd say no way, no chance. But here we are, right?
Yep.
It's unbelievable. And I think our generation is probably responsible for the legalization of pot because I know it wasn't my parents' generation, right?
Yeah.
So it's an incredible shift in thinking about the world and what people are up to and keeping government out and saying these things aren't as bad as we thought. So it's interesting. And we don't have to go down this rabbit hole of
an interesting rabbit hole.
It is. And cause everybody has an opinion about it. Mm-hmm. Everyone's for the most part, you know, has interacted with it on some level, whether as a prosecutor, you know, getting people in trouble for it or as none of us are users in on this podcast though, that's for sure. And we certainly don't endorse.
No, we're not on an endorsement tour here.
Of course not. But all right. So, after you leave the prosecutor's office, you decide to go into private practice? Or?
Well, after I was with the prosecutor's office for about 2 years, my wife was accepted into the veterinary school at the University of Illinois.
Oh, fantastic.
And it's a fantastic veterinary school. It's it's a great opportunity. And so we decided to move down to Urbana. Mm-hmm. And so we lived in Champaign-Urbana for 4 years. And during that time, I worked for a plaintiff's personal injury firm. And I represented injured parties suing insurance companies for compensation for their injuries. My face was on billboards, on park benches, and it was a great experience because if you know anything about personal injury law, you're generally looking, going back to the politics, you're generally looking for blue state Democrat jurors. Blue state Democrats understand that insurance companies should pay when people are injured. Now, Champaign-Urbana, Decatur, Peoria, Springfield. I don't know if all your listeners know Central Illinois, but let me assure you, those are extremely red parts of the country. And still got a couple of pretty good victories down there. And again, that was tremendous trial experience because you walk into a courtroom in Central Illinois representing a plaintiff suing State Farm Insurance, for example, or Country Companies. Those are two hometown players. Mm-hmm. You're immediately in second place. What are you doing here? Explain yourself, justify your case at every step.
Oh, wow.
So that approach was, and I had a great attorney that I was working with. I was essentially the lieutenant for somebody that taught me so much about civil litigation, so much about how you need to be aggressive, how you need to exercise judgment at all times, how you need to be both, you know, selective in how you communicate and what cases you take and what actions you take. And it was tremendously helpful. And from that, I learned how aggressive you need to be if you're representing a plaintiff. And I don't represent injury clients as much anymore, but a lot of my clients are in disputes regarding property and money. And if we're going to claim that we are owed compensation or that the other side has breached the contract or that they've stolen from us or defrauded us, we have to sustain the burden of proof. If we fail to prove it, our case, we lose. So my background has been in the plaintiff side, in proving cases, in figuring out the witnesses that we need to call and the questions we need to ask them to get the evidence in the methods that we need to do to preserve the evidence in the first couple of days and weeks of a case, in the seeking of the information from the other side that's either going to help your case or foreclose them from arguing a defense. These are all strategies that I learned and I apply every day in litigation of these business cases that I handle now.
That's amazing. When you talk about being aggressive, right, because I think it can have a different meaning, you know, and I think it's also an interesting study in emotional intelligence, which I talk about all the time on this podcast. And just listening to you now, because you don't seem to get emotional about, just from meeting you sitting across the table from me. And I'm sort of the opposite way, which I think was a detriment to me as trying litigation cases, because you know everything was, I would want ready to fight. But fighting is different. You know, maybe there are procedural levers you can push on a little bit harder and posturing that way. It's not necessarily just, you know, pumping up your chest. There are other ways of being aggressive that don't involve, you know, being the loudest guy in the room, right? Sort of a different way of thinking.
Yeah. No, and in my communication style, you're 100% right. Most disputes at some point get to the point where a lawyer sends a letter. It's referred to as a demand letter. And I do this all the time. And I know that simply putting a letter on letterhead and saying that I represent this person with regard to a certain apparent dispute, and then I describe the dispute, I know that there's a certain level of aggression there. What I work with my clients when I write these letters, I say, I need your input on two areas primarily. I understand the legal situation because we've talked about it. I understand the general facts. But from my client, I need them to give me input on two areas. One, my tone, and two, my facts. So tone means they know the audience. They know if this person is going to be more receptive to honey, which of course attracts bees, or vinegar, okay? And honey and vinegar, they both work. They both work 100%. But you can only go one way. You can't be vinegar first and then be honey because they hate you. You have to be honey first. And if honey doesn't work, well, then you can turn to vinegar. But that's the only way it works. It
doesn't work the other way.
And so after we talk about tone and they review my letter and make sure I'm not too over the top, because what can happen is I can start with an even keel, But after a half hour writing this letter, I'm angry. I'm an advocate for my clients. Sure. I side with them.
You want to win.
And by the end, I want to put exclamation points in there.
Right, everything in all caps.
But so after we agree that the tone is right, I make sure that all the dates, dollar amounts, mm-hmm. addresses, people's names, sequences, events are accurate. The reason why that's so important is when somebody reads one of these lawyer letters, they don't want the conclusion to be true. The conclusion is always pay my client X dollars by Y date, stop doing something that we don't want you to do, start doing the thing that you promised to do that you don't want to do. Mm-hmm. They don't want the conclusion to be true. So if they identify factual errors in the document, they can say, well, wait a minute. If the lawyer's wrong about the date, if the lawyer transposed two digits in the address, well, clearly he doesn't know what he's talking about. Clearly, I'm not wrong. I'm right. So we need to make sure that they don't have those, they're logical fallacies, but they don't have those fallacious handholds out of the conclusion that is they need to pay.
All right. You don't want to give your opponent anything to work with, any reason to say that what you're saying is factually incorrect, and here's why.
Ideally, no unforced errors.
Yeah. So, and that's it's, it creates pressure, and because you make mistakes as humans. I mean, it's just sort of like how it goes, and then
that's usually why they come to me.
Yeah, and it's why they're there in the first place, right?
Yeah.
But you know, as you were talking about writing the letters, I wanted to ask you about AI. You know, because AI, you know, it's a trendy topic. Everybody has a comment on it. But you know, because I think when I first used ChatGPT, and think about what application could it be used for, and I thought about well lawyers, right? Because I actually was playing around with it, and I had it write me a lease. You know, you throw in some dates or terms, and it spits out. Maybe it's a passable lease. Maybe probably not. I don't know. But I thought, well, geez, it can only get better. And as a lawyer, do you use ChatGPT? Are you aware of it? Are you concerned about it? How do you feel about it?
I'm very aware of it. I think that it's got tremendous potential in the marketing. In helping with marketing campaigns, there's a lot of potential for it. If I've been practicing for 20 years, mm-hmm. if I was perhaps 2 years out of law school, I think AI might be a very valuable tool for me. And let me explain why. So what you can do with the AI is give it enough prompts to create a lease for you or some other contract. And a lot of my work is related to these contracts. They're sometimes 3 or 4 pages long, if we're really lucky. Sometimes they're 30 pages. I did a lease just a couple months ago that was 68 pages. Mm. So, and really small type. And so with these documents, yes, you could probably prompt AI to do that. And then if you're doing your job, you're going to read every freaking word and every sentence and punctuation and make sure it all holds water. If it's something where there's legal citations with court cases, you're going to look them all up. Now, I could do that now with AI. But what I could also do is listen to my client and think about when's the last time we had a shopping center lease where there was an issue where we wanted to have an option to purchase the other space. Oh, yeah, we did that 4 years ago. What was the name of that client? Oh, okay. Now I just found it on my database. I can copy and paste something that's going to be 10 times better than what AI did. So for inexperienced attorneys who are then supervised by experienced attorneys, I think AI can work. For a solo practitioner who doesn't have an experienced person to look over their work product after they've edited the AI, mm-hmm. I don't think they can do that.
Yeah, it's probably pretty risky.
It's just as risky as finding a form off the internet and assuming the form that you found is a good fit for your situation.
Yeah, and if you're an attorney, you know, trying to do those types of contracts, you probably shouldn't be practicing that type of law. If you need to like do AI to help. I think AI is great to get you started. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, everything I'm saying today into the microphone is all written by AI. I'm looking at it right here. So yep. Not one of these words. And I'm making a joke. But as a starting point, because I'd use it for marketing for me. Yeah. Because you know, it's hard to be creative on demand. And I use it just maybe to get my brain warmed up and give me some ideas. Oh, I could work with that and take it in and internalize it and make it my own. Because I know if I'm not doing it, certainly, you know, my competition's doing it. And then they're going to be able to produce me and content and marketing, and then I can't keep up and you're dead in the water.
You are correct there. And so there is some thought to competitive disadvantage. And, you know, perhaps AI will create a race to the bottom where firms are expected to produce as if they're using AI. And so if they're not using AI, then it's going to cost more to produce the same level of production as far as the marketplace. You know, clients may be only willing to pay a certain amount because they expect AI to be in there. I don't think that there's a force for that now. I think a lot of people, when they hire lawyers, they think of prestige pricing.
Sure, sure.
But that may be the case in 20 years where people are expecting, you know, AI cost to be passed along to the clients. And in that situation, it'll be very difficult because you'll be expecting attorneys to make a living doing more work than before. And that means each attorney is going to handle more cases and probably do a worse job because it's more human beings than you can effectively manage. I've heard people say that you can only really know 250 people, no matter how...
It seems like a lot to me.
But how can you keep track of more than that many people?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to feel so overwhelming.
And the relationship that attorneys have with their clients is much more intimate than that.
Yeah.
So I think that there's problems to it. I think there's absolutely advantages to it. If I've used it a little bit to summarize documents, Adobe offers that feature. And what that helps me do is to go to the places in the document that I want to read much faster. It's faster than Control F.
Sure.
Where you know, we do that all the time. We use copy paste. We use different ways to search within documents. And if AI can get me to the answer of a 150-page PDF faster, then the client pays less because I bill on a 6-minute basis, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. So yeah, I see a lot of benefits to it, but there's a lot of pitfalls.
You know, if you were in law school today, I think having that ability to summarize, you know, cases quickly probably does a pretty decent job. You don't have maybe to get by, not be a star, but as a starting point, I know if I was in law school, I'd probably be putting all those cases that we had to read, you know, especially like the very obscure constitutional law cases that were, you know, some of them are heavy and hard to get through. And if I can get some help with AI, not cheating, and it's just giving me, you know, ideas and thoughts, then I know if I'm not going to use it, somebody else's, and maybe they'll have an advantage of me.
Well, I think definitely law school students should be taught in their curriculum how to use AI. They should, because you're coming out of law school, you want to be hired. I think that firms are going to be looking for people that know how to use every tool of technology.
Yeah.
When we hire younger attorneys, we're not expecting to teach them how to use the tools that we have. I think they should be taught how to use it. When I was in law school, one of the most beneficial things for me was to retype my notes. So that was back in the day where most of the people didn't have computers. Half of them had computers in the classroom, half of them didn't. But the process of going through what you've already taken your notes and turning that into your outline, I think that is a very good process for me. That's kind of a process that I use in my trial preparation, and I wouldn't want to lose that for my own learning style.
You know, that's interesting because I did the same thing as well. And you and I, the same age, we graduated from high school in the same year. I won't say the year because it'll give away our ages. But, you know, because we're of a generation that's very special because we remember life, you know, sort of like before computers and cell phones. And now we remember life and we know life after, obviously. And I think, you know, we're able to adapt a lot better than maybe an older generation. And we sort of can communicate even with the younger generations. Because I don't know about you, and I've said this a million times on the air, you know, we're like Gen X, but we're like really sort of like not Gen X. We're sort of like on that cusp. I know for me, I relate more to the millennials than because the Gen Xers, for the most part, are like in their 50s.
Yeah,
they seem old. They seem old to me.
I like their music.
Great music.
They got the better music,
right?
But I think they're calling it Zennials now.
Yeah. So you know, or the Oregon Trail generation. Remember the game Oregon Trail?
Yeah, I do.
So that was like you and I are of that age where it's. You know, we're special because we can learn new technology. I'm not intimidated by it. I don't know if you are, but I'm not.
No.
And so I think that puts us in a really unique position to be able to communicate with the younger generation. We know how to communicate with the older generation. You know, as my parents, for example, you know, they're aware of technology. I mean, they have iPhones. And for the most part, they can get by. But I always make this joke. I've made it 100 times that if my mom wanted to find this podcast, you know, I don't know if she could. She'd probably say, hey, can you text it to me? And so she can text it to her friends. So I think, you know, there is, and I think that she doesn't want to learn. Like, it's sort of like a,
right.
There's something there in that generation where it's just like not, they don't just don't understand how incredibly powerful it can be. And maybe they just don't care because it's, they lived long enough without having to deal with it.
You know, I feel the resistance to change rising in me though. As I get older, here's the new social network. Well, I'm not going to join that one.
Right.
That one's just going to be a flash in the pan.
Right. Yeah. I bet you're dancing all over TikTok, right?
And no, I'm not. but you know, there is a certain resistance to change and uncomfortability with change that I'm noticing as I get older. And I don't know if that's part of the zeitgeist right now, because obviously you're seeing that in folks that are much older. They're very resistant.
I mean, do you find that you know, sort of like, you know, you think about how your parents or your dad acted when you were a kid, and you're like, and you say something maybe to your kid and you're like, my God, take a step back. You're like, sounded like my dad.
Mm-hmm.
It is an odd feeling that like suddenly you've like stepped into his shoes unintentionally without knowing it, but that's just how it works. You know, his stamp of him is in you. Because I find myself all the time, and people say I even sound like my dad.
Mm-hmm.
But when I hear my voice and I hear him, I'm like, there's no way. But I guess, you know, it's sort of like with aging, that's, you become your it's like a Curb Your Enthusiasm episode. You're like, suddenly you're like a curmudgeon.
Yes.
Like,
oh, it's the eighth inning. We better get going. Beat the traffic.
Right? My parents leave for the airport not like 10 hours before the airport, the plane. And I always have this thing about being prompt. When I was in college, I was late. My parents were in town visiting. Went to Tulane in New Orleans. We're going to a fancy dinner, and I was late. And I don't know if I had a cell phone. I don't think, you know, maybe, maybe not. But I certainly didn't let him know I was running late. And man, he let me have it. And from that day up until today, being on time, I'm like, I can hear my dad's voice yelling at me. Like, and now I tell my kids, you know, and I sound like my dad yelling at me back in 94, whatever that was, to like, Aaron, that was incredibly disrespectful for you to be late, right? It's crazy how that happens, because when you're young, you know, you think you stay young forever, and then suddenly you're not, in a flash.
Yeah.
Anyway, now this has gone off the rails a little bit. So let's
Boomer talk's over.
Was that Boomer talk? Yeah. Has anyone of your kids ever called you Boomer? They go, okay, Boomer?
No.
Okay. Neither of mine. I think they think it. They want to say it to me.
No.
I'm
usually the one with the young mind around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. Me too. And I think my kids look at me and they're like, do they look at me as an old guy? Because I don't feel like an old guy.
Yeah.
But we are kind of old
guys. Well, we played Oregon Trail, me and my 10-year-old on the Xbox just the other day.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Same sort of like the kids are going to get cholera and you have to go hunting.
It's a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
There's a lot more things to do and it looks better.
Yeah,
of course. It's the same game. It's the same game. You buy your supplies. Things happen.
The Indians are going to come attack your camp. And
I haven't had that one yet, but you can hunt, you can fish, and just random opportunities to either help people or be mean to people along the way. And
you get the flu and everybody dies.
You got to ford the rivers.
Yeah, that was an important part.
Rivers runs wild.
Yeah, that's dangerous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. My kids play Fortnite, which, I mean, visually, it's like incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a lesson there? Like, it's a shoot 'em up game. It's not really the greatest, but man, they are into it.
Yeah.
And they study it. And you go on social media and see what other people are doing. So like from that perspective, I say, okay, they're figuring out how to solve problems. You know, maybe they're like, even though using AI almost, like just going onto TikTok and seeing how other people beat levels or do certain tricks or whatever. So I don't know. I don't know what the result is either.
Yeah.
So, but do you have your kids on social media?
Never. No, he's only 10 years old. One son.
Oh, see, I have my daughter's 11 and she's like all over social media.
Yeah.
Nah, not in a bad way, but she watches it. She consumes it, but she'll be okay. At least I tell myself, I'll tell myself that. All right. So anyway, getting back to the law stuff. So your firm is located where?
Downtown Libertyville. So if you're familiar with Lake County, Libertyville is right in the middle. And it's got a cute little downtown, a lot like Highland Park.
Mm-hmm.
And so our office is right in the central area. That's where I've been since about 2011. And I haven't been in the same place, but within about a block or so. People like coming to downtown Libertyville, I think.
Yeah,
I think
it's nice there.
It's a great place to do business. And, you know, I most of our clients come from Lake County, and they find it to be a good place to visit. But we do meetings by Zoom and by phone as well. So,
but you'll get on the road and be the county lawyer in DuPage or
absolutely
or Wheaton yeah. DuPage and like Cook County.
Right. So sometimes we're down in Wheaton. A lot of times I'll go to Skokie. A lot of times I'll go to Rolling Meadows. Those are the two northernmost courthouses in Cook County. And then the Daly Center is where the law divisions are in Cook County. So if we've got a big argument over property and money in Chicago, that's where we go. And our firm also has a number of cases at the Dirksen Building. And the Dirksen Building is federal court. That's down in Chicago as well.
And that's a whole different ball of procedures and things to worry about in federal court because they don't mess around there.
They do not mess around.
That is a serious place. I never tried a case, but I definitely was like participated and watched. And I was thinking to myself, wow, this is a whole nother procedurals I have to think about and judges' personalities you have to get to know. And it's a little bit intimidating there.
There's a lot of really great things about being in federal court, but it's higher pressure, I believe.
Totally.
It's shorter, harder deadlines. And often it's much more expensive for the client.
Yeah.
So the thought process is usually when you're representing somebody in a dispute is, how can we solve this without going to court? And then we have to get a good understanding of what it means to go to court in this case. You know, it means certainly spending a lot of money up front, and it means putting the case into risk because you're truly going after the bird in the bush at that point. You may get a negative ruling at the end of this trial that you spent so much time and money preparing for. And so, you know, in federal court, that's all part of the thinking as well. They tend to go faster, but it's not less work. So that means it's more intense. It's more financially intense for the clients, and they got to understand that.
Yeah, and part of being a lawyer, you talked about risk. Because, you know, as a lawyer, you control what you can control. I used to tell my clients, you know, listen, the other side is going to do whatever they're going to do. They're going to write whatever letter they're going to, and they're going to say whatever they want in that letter. And you can't control that. But you can control, you know, what you're doing. You can control the tone of your letters, like you were talking about earlier, or the words you use, or the things that you can control, whether procedurally or whatever. But that's really hard for clients to sort of like stomach that, because you want to be able to control everything, especially as a business owner, right? And when things get out of control or feel that you don't have control, it's a really disconcerting feeling. And as a lawyer, you have to sort of manage those expectations and communicate that, and the client has to understand that, right?
Well, we communicate it. It's difficult to understand, though. And what I always tell people is about 85% of your costs in litigation are going to be driven by the other side. So if we're the plaintiff, we're the person that brings the case, immediately the other side has the opportunity to either answer our complaint. And if they do that, then the lawsuit will basically focus on the aspects of our complaint that they denied, because that's what we're arguing about, the difference between what we think the case is and what they're willing to admit the case is. On the other hand, they might immediately move to dismiss the case. They might say that my complaint is bad because of some rule of law, something that I did not add to the complaint, or some other fact that they might bring in that defeats my plaintiff's claim. If they do that, well, they'll now write probably a 15-page motion full of cases and arguments and all that stuff. And then it'll be my job to respond in about a 15-page motion to all the reasons why they're wrong. And then they'll have the opportunity to reply in a 5-page reply. Then, after everybody's read all these things and the judge has read them, then we're going to go to court and probably argue for an hour or hour and a half, something like that. And then the judge is going to give us a ruling. If they file that motion to dismiss, the case is probably going to be delayed 3 to 4 months, and it's probably going to cost maybe an extra $5,000 or $10,000, maybe a little bit less, but it's going to cost that money. If they had not filed that motion to dismiss, you would not have those costs. You would not have that delay. There are many times when that can happen in a case, many different forks in the road that your opponent can choose to take. And if they do, your costs will be higher. I'm usually able to give a fairly decent ballpark on what your costs are going to be based on the work that I need to do to either, if I'm defending a case, to defend your case, or if I'm your plaintiff's attorney, to represent you through the bringing of your case. But if the other side is filing frivolous motions or successive motions, because they could file two motions to dismiss, one right after another, and at the end of the evidence, they could file a motion for summary judgment. Every time they do this, it alters your costs and it alters your time. Sometimes, you know, in Lake County, you file a case for over $50,000, you probably go to trial in about 13 months. Cook County, that's probably about twice as long. But there's things that can delay both of those cases, and clients need to have an understanding of the time and, as best as they can, the money that's going to be involved.
You know, I, an attorney friend of mine who was sort of a, you know, he helped me a lot, and he had a, he had an interesting way, perspective of dealing with that issue when you talk to his clients. He'd refer it to, like, you know, you line up the horses in a horse race, and you want the gates to open, and the horses are going to start racing. And those types of motions, whether it's a motion to dismiss or they file some other motion before they've even answered the complaint, the horses haven't even been put in line yet. Mm-mm. And your client's thinking, like, we're off in the races. And you're saying, well, hang on. The horses have not even, they're not even at the gate yet.
Yeah.
So think about that in terms of a race, that it's a marathon. And, you know, it's going to take time. And there's definitely, you know, attrition happens. It's part of the game, I think. Mm-hmm. The other side can take advantage of you know, sort of bleeding you, your client money dry, and that someone has to say, you know, give up and give in. And it's hard.
Yep.
And but that's how the system is set up, whether it's good or bad. You know, I don't know. It seems to work in a democratic society. I don't know how, you know, certainly the alternative in another society would be not so fun, not so fair.
Yeah. I don't know a better alternative.
There's probably no better alternative, but that's why this country is fantastic. But it is a total financial game when it comes to those types of disputes. To take the emotion out of it and think about it as a marathon of a horse race. You guys aren't even in the gates yet. Start getting ready to go. So that's an interesting, you know, procedure obstacle that people think it's just right out. You know, you file a complaint, you go right to trial. But there's a lot that can happen between
absolutely
that and getting there, right?
There's so many ways that anything can go. So if we're defending a complaint and we think that there's issues with it, we might file a motion to dismiss right now. Or we might let the case go along and we might get to the evidentiary stage, and then we might file the motion to dismiss either as a motion for summary judgment or as a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And so the question is, do you want to let the other side know that you think that they've filed a very weak complaint, or do you want to just defeat it at a motion for summary judgment? And the reason why is because a decision on summary judgment is much more likely to be final and upheld and to stick. Because if you win on a motion to dismiss, the other side appeals, you could be back in court in 6 or 9 months.
Yeah, I think judges would say, well, let's give him another shot. Give him another shot to amend his complaint.
Oh, yeah.
Try again.
It happens.
And then you can file another motion to dismiss because they still haven't gotten it right. So it can be an incredibly tedious and long and expensive
process. And that just happened in one of my cases. It's active right now. We filed the second motion to dismiss, and we got half the counts dismissed, and half the counts are by the end of the two motions to dismiss, there's one third of the counts remaining that were originally filed. But I believe that we're not done yet because we think that it was an error. So, you know, it just depends on the case, the facts, the law. We don't make decisions just for the pragmatic effect of delaying a case or fighting a case or interposing a defense that we don't think is a winner.
Yeah.
It just costs too much, and you don't want to argue losers. So I'm not in the business of a game of attrition or forcing attrition. But if the case should be dismissed, it should be dismissed. And you know, sometimes a plaintiff simply cannot plead the facts, meaning they can't cite the instances of fact in their situation that qualifies them for the relief that they're seeking. And, you know, that is the part of the pleading process that we're describing. And the idea is only good cases go forward.
Yeah, so if a plaintiff doesn't have the facts, then they don't have the facts. You can't make them up or try to, you know, skirmish your way around them. Your opponent's going to pick up on them, and he's going to exploit them and get your case dismissed. So if you don't have the facts, then you don't have the facts. And that's you're going to run into that roadblock. What about settling? I'd like to think that, you know, everyone expects some sort of settlement.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, you know, we're not going to go to trial. I think there's sort of maybe undertones of, like, every case probably more likely than not is going to settle. When strategically, whether you're on the plaintiff or defendant, do you call up the other side and say, wait a minute, let's start talking? Or do you keep those talks going maybe the whole time?
Always be settling.
Always be
settling. Just like Alec Baldwin and Glengarry Glen Ross, always be settling. They should always know your position. Usually in the very beginning of the case, I try to have a conversation with the other side to and I try to listen, because what I'm listening for are, what are their interests? What are their pain points? What are they looking for? How can I create value for them? Because if I can create value for them at relatively low cost to my client, well, then that's going to be allow them to give us value where we need it. So there's a lot of reading between the lines in these things. And so a lot of times the written correspondence that goes back and forth between the lawyers is not the same as what the lawyers are talking about orally. So for example, I have a case right now where a lot of cases are essentially, you didn't do what you were paid to do in this contract versus you didn't pay me the way you promised to pay me. And that's often the dispute, and both sides are right, of course. And so I have one of those now where we are the party that has been partially paid and is being expected to continue their performance, and they'll be fully paid upon full performance. But the recipient has been doing all sorts of things to make this very difficult for us. And so right now the parties are somewhat odds. And I received a letter from the attorney representing the other party, and I've written enough of these letters and I've read enough of these letters to see all the nasty things that that person's putting in the letter, but to know it could be a lot worse. He could be accusing my client of various things that he's not. He could be making arguments that he's not. And so that to me says, oh, they're absolutely open to settlement. So I called him and I said, listen, I got that letter and I appreciate everything in there, but I also appreciate that it could have been a lot worse. I want you to know that we're interested in settlement. Your client might not have told you these facts. And then I tell him all the things that his client is doing to make my client's life terrible.
As a lawyer, you never want to be in that situation where you don't know the whole story, right? That's a huge disadvantage.
Exactly. And then I told him, I'm not going to put these things that I just told you in a letter because I know that they're inflammatory and I know it's not productive to settlement. If we have to go in a dispute, you know that these are going to be our arguments, but I'm not going to put it in the letter that I'm sending to you that you're going to send your client. And then what we've kind of proposed to do is, you know, there was contracts exchanged between these clients. The lawyers are going to punch them up, make sure that they're good and solid, and they actually state what the parties are in agreement to do. And then hopefully they sign them, they perform, they go their separate ways. That's always the goal, is that we can fix the dispute, get out of the dispute, and then leave it to the clients.
Yeah, you should hope that reasonable minds prevail.
Yeah.
Not always the case, but definitely. It's a great, very pragmatic way of approaching disputes, right? The lawyers, if you have a good relationship with the lawyer, that, you know, you sort of understand that let's talk, real talk, I guess, and not posture and
I know you have claims. You know that I have claims.
Right.
What's it going to take to solve this? Let's not argue. You've got a case. I got a case. Let's not argue about that. Let's talk about the solution.
I like that. I like that because I think that's good to hear from a lawyer who's in the trenches, because I think sometimes lawyers get a, you know, and whether it's true or not, get a sort of an unfair rap that, you know, that they like to see cases are fought to the very end. And I don't think that's the case at all, because it's not fair. You have a stake in the relationship with that client, and you don't want to spend their money like that.
There is a thought that some attorneys are selfish and greedy and do not settle cases that could be settled early and want to work up cases more than is appropriate. My view is always we get paid very well for what we do. We don't need to overbill. We don't need to do any of those things. We should be assiduously accurate with our billing because we still get paid a lot. There's no reason to try to make a quick buck in what we do. Attorneys are not, you know, we're not interested. I mean, the good ones, at least that I know, are not interested in the quick buck because, you know, you want to be doing this for years. You want to be referred clients by clients who are satisfied, and you want to be well regarded in your legal community. In Lake County, we've got a pretty small legal community, probably about 1,000 lawyers. And we know who the bad guys are. We know who you cannot trust, and they are treated differently.
Yeah. And that's important to say, because you do get that reputation. And it's hard to clear that up. So that's good stuff. Well, listen, we've been talking now for, 51 minutes. I think it's gone very fast. What do you think?
Yeah, it's been great.
I think
it's very interesting.
No, I think it really has. Because I haven't thought about this loss, whether you know, thinking about motion to dismiss or civil procedure in a long time.
Yeah.
So I sort of walked away from it. But it's all still up there. Like I think I could probably walk into a court and understand what's going on and whether I'd be good at it or not. I don't know if I could write a comprehensive response to a motion to dismiss. Maybe. With AI, I could maybe.
You know, it's all about communication. And the best attorneys are capable of shifting phases. They're capable of talking to their client in their own language and explaining in the simplest terms as necessary the rule of law. I told you about my son. I often talk to my son about cases without any private details.
It's an interesting perspective as a kid's thinking about right and wrong and how to handle things.
And these are complicated cases I'm discussing with him and involving different breaches of contract and all that stuff. And my thinking is, if I can't explain it to him, I don't understand it well enough to argue it. Because while we're in court, the demeanor, the words chosen, the way you dress, the way you do comport yourself in total is entirely different from when you're dealing with your son, when you're dealing with your client. But effective lawyers are able to communicate in all those media and to explain it, because essentially a lot of argument and advocacy, I think, is explaining.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because as you're talking, I was thinking about my cousin Vinny for some reason.
Yeah.
Because you're thinking about, you know, how lawyers have to change their, and the character, you know, the main character, you know, he did not change at all.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know where I was going with that. It was just the thought that came to my head in that movie is in terms of lawyers and communication. But for him,
but that's so unrealistic because you know people with a heavy, thick New York accent. And you know that they can dial it down a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, well, the two Utes.
Right? Yeah, yeah, right.
That was a great movie.
When I was in law school for a while at University of Cincinnati, which is an inner city school, I taught a curriculum called Street Law. And that was a volunteer thing. And for that, we did watch an edited version. These kids, they didn't need the editing. They knew all the words, but we watched an edited version of that movie because I really did think it, and I do think it's a very good legal movie. It talks about discovery. It talks about the right of confrontation. It even talks about hearsay.
Yeah, and you know, Chris cross-examining the old lady, and he gets her to admit that she couldn't see it with the glasses, the whole thing. Yeah, it's a great movie. So, you know, I think about movies that were influential on me and what my kids are watching, and you know, they don't watch... movies are very different these days than they were when we were kids. Like those movies had meaning and substance. And maybe it's just me acting like my father now.
Right.
Like my dad. I tried to show my kids a Romeo and Juliet. I thought, you know, listen, Taylor Swift sings about Romeo and Juliet. They were not interested.
Yeah.
So they have to consider the source. They're coming from their dad, who's probably uncool. But again, I don't know where I'm going with this line of questioning.
Kids have trouble with people communicating in means that they're not used to. So whether it's the language of Shakespeare being different or listening to somebody with a British accent, I noticed that a lot of people have hesitancy to accept authority, information from people that speak differently than themselves.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's definitely, well, listen, my ex-wife, my in-laws are from South Africa. So my kids were sort of exposed to, you know, people talk different or sound different. But, you know, when I first met my ex-wife and I hear that, definitely you're sort of perk up and they're looked at differently. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just human nature. You can't change, you know, just different.
We're good at spotting things like that.
Yeah.
We're very good at recognizing patterns and recognizing when something doesn't fit the pattern.
Yeah, and then I found myself, you know, speaking like them, sort of like that Madonna syndrome when she started speaking with a British accent. Every so often when I'd be talking to my in-laws or my wife or whatever, I'd fall into the South African accent. I'm not going to do it on the air.
No, you're
really bad at it.
You're shifting phase so that you can better communicate with the people that you're with.
That's right. You're sort of like, you know your audience. Maybe as a lawyer, when you're speaking to a jury, you have to sort of have to be very self-aware of how you sound.
Usually I'm speaking to jurors, the jury.
Not the jury.
So when we pick a jury, we're trying to pick the most biased jury possible for our client. We want to kick off all the bad juries.
Right.
And we want all of our soldiers on the jury. And then when I'm giving my closing argument, I'm concentrating on giving ammunition to my soldiers. because what's going to happen is my soldiers are going to go back into the room, and it's only going to be them against the enemy. And I hope that I've given them enough ammunition, and I hope that I've kicked off all the bad shepherds, and that my soldiers are shepherds. Because when you go back into that jury room, one person is going to lead them. Mm-hmm. And jury trials are tremendously stressful. They're tremendously intense, and they're tremendously rewarding. And I really enjoy the trial process. Can't wait for my next one.
Did you enjoy back in the criminal trials or civil trials? I mean, which and I say enjoy, yeah. But which I don't, you know, so I don't know what the right term would be.
Right. So I absolutely, the best years of my life were at the prosecutor's office because of the team environment. But what I really like about my practice now is that I've got the time to craft arguments, to develop the evidence. So in those criminal cases, you basically get the evidence delivered to you. Here's the packet of evidence. Here's the police reports. If it's a bigger case, you can ask the investigators to go out and get more evidence. But essentially, it's given to you. You have very little agency over your case. Mm. As a civil attorney, you meet with your clients and you come up with a strategy. Okay, who are our witnesses? What evidence do they have? Where can we get the documents from? So if there's a non-party that has documents, like somebody who's not in the lawsuit, well, we send them a subpoena. And then are they going to respond to the subpoena? What's our strategy to get those documents? The way that you can build your own, absolutely, that's a part of it. It's a very expensive part of it. And if you can get the evidence through not doing a deposition, you usually try to do that. But how do you build your case? And you get, you know, 13, 16, 18 months to do this. And by the time that you're in front of that jury, if your case goes the distance, because most of them don't, you know it back and forward. You've thought about how you're going to do this for the last 3 months. You haven't slept for the last 3 days. Your client and you have been texting constantly, and you know what he or she was doing 6 years to the day better than they do because you've been outlining it for the last week. So no, that's what I enjoy more, because then it's your thing as opposed to you're just simply playing the cards that you've been dealt. When you're a civil litigation attorney, you've had the case for the whole time. You have a hand in the cards that you're dealt. You can determine what cards you have at the trial because you've developed the evidence yourself. So no, I do enjoy that more. It takes longer.
Yeah, and I was going to ask about jury selection, and we could probably have a whole podcast episode on that, because that to me, I tried to, a few cases, and jury selection I was intimidated by that. I just didn't, you know, they tell you, you know, you get some advice from the partners, but, you know, is it more of an art form or science to like understanding what jurors, be able to predict
how they're going to
decide on something? It's very difficult.
Right. So with jury selection, there's a couple of things in play. One is, how does the judge do it? Every judge in every courtroom does it a little bit differently. So depending on how the judge sets the rules for jury selection, is it going to impact your strategy? So how many strikes does each side get? Are they allowed to do something called back striking? And then if a juror is struck, well, then who is the replacement? So we get an idea of who the people are sitting in the box right now. If those people are kicked off, then somebody is going to take their place. What do we think about the people that are going to come take their place? Is it simply going to be the next person in line? Or is it going to be somebody from the veneer who we haven't asked any questions to, that's a total unknown? And so what we often try to do with jury selection is we are given a limited number of strikes that we can use for any reason. I don't like that person. I don't like them the way they walk. I saw him carrying a book on the way in by a political person I think would be bad. I just don't like people who have that haircut. I think they would be bad for my client. Any reason whatsoever, you can strike. Usually five. That's usually what you get. Sometimes seven. It just depends. But then you see a juror that you don't like. You don't want to use those five strikes. You want to preserve your five strikes. So you try to get the judge to strike them. So you try to demonstrate that juror that you don't like cannot be fair. And usually what you try to do is to get them to agree with certain statements. So you play the other side and you describe your grandmother who is set in her ways. She's earned that right. She's old enough. She understands right and wrong. And nothing one of these lawyers is going to say in, what, a two-day trial, nothing's going to change her mind. She knows that certain things are true. And does anybody here in this room agree with that? And then somebody's going to raise their hand. Then I'm going to talk to that person, and I'm going to laud and approve of and encourage that point of view. And then, you know, once they've said that they're, of course, they're opinionated because they've seen the world. They understand how things work, and they're proud of their viewpoints. And then I'll walk up to the judge and say, she can't be fair. You got to get rid of her, judge. And then the other side will then try to rehabilitate that person if they want her on the jury or him on the jury. They'll ask that person questions like, okay, but you can be fair, right? You're going to follow the law, right? Mm-hmm. And then the lawyers have to argue whether or not that person actually can be fair. And if we're able to convince the judge they can't, the judge has unlimited strikes, and I've just preserved my strike. And then if the judge says, no, I'm not going to strike this person for cause because I haven't established cause, then I'll have to decide, is it worth a strike? And in some situations, I could strike that person, and then the other side could decide to strike a person 4 people ago that they let go before. So there's a lot of strategy involved. But essentially what you're trying to do is one of the main and this is all pseudoscience, psychological stuff.
It's an art form, right?
Yeah, it's not a science, it's an art. But the prevailing wisdom is in the jury room, there's only 2 types of people, sheep and shepherds. And the sheep are the people that are just, let's just get done. They're willing. They're either persuadable or they don't care enough, and they'll go along with it. Mm-hmm. And then there's shepherds, and you want to pick the shepherds. You want the shepherds to be your people, and you can't always be right, but that's what you try to do. And then you arm your shepherds, which is much ammunition. You look for people who are nodding at you. You look for people who are open. You look for people dressed the way that you think somebody who would agree with your client would be dressed.
That's an interesting, you know, way to think of it, psychology. Whether it is a bunch of just sort of smoke and mirrors or if it's real or not.
It might be a lot of junk.
Yeah.
Because you got to pick somebody.
Yeah.
And then you got to justify the decision to your client. So
right.
That could be a big part.
And if your client loses, then it's like, well, you picked that juror. It was wrong. You should have stricken them. And then it's like, well, you're money murder quarterback. Here's 2020.
And you
hindsight, know, 2020.
And clients are really great from this. I mean, there's been a couple of times when I've picked a jury with my client there, and they'll just say, I don't like this person. And I'll say, okay, we're getting rid of them. And they were 100% right, 100%. And, you know, as when I'm doing jury selection, I'm taking notes really quickly. I'm trying to listen very intently, and I'm also trying to look at them. My client is typically just staring them down. So that second set of eyes is very helpful.
That's interesting. Have you ever personally served on a jury? Ever gotten called and gotten picked?
I've been personally kicked off of juries, or I've been deselected. So the very first case after COVID, I came in and I sat down in the jury box. So there's a selection process, mm-hmm. but I was selected and I went into the courtroom, and the judge immediately recognized me, and he made sure that the attorneys asked me questions fairly quickly. They could determine that I was an attorney, that I represented people in cases like this, mm-hmm. and I was instantly
gone. Out of here.
Yeah. And I think that one of the sides had to use a strike because I said, of course I'd be fair, and I would. But I definitely would, you know,
I don't think into it
from a point of view, and you never want an attorney on your jury because they're uncontrollable. You don't know what an attorney is going to do.
Remember they used to say like school teachers were like really good to have in juries.
Well, if you're defending criminal case, yes. School teachers are typically good for a criminal defendant. They'd probably be good for a personal injury plaintiff as well.
Interesting. See, there's all these little tricks and psychology things that, you know, you got to get thrown in the trenches to learn all that stuff. That's not stuff they teach necessarily in law school. Maybe in a courtroom class, but
you just never know though, because you don't have the ability to ask enough questions. And so there's a guy who teaches jury selection, and he said, you know, in one of his very first cases, there was a person who said that they were in the military for 2 years. And he thought to himself, well, a military person would be good for this. Hmm. He didn't bother to ask him what he did in the military. Oh, okay.
Whoops.
And then later on, he ended up winning the case that he was defending. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because that guy that was the military guy, what did he do? He was a prosecutor. He was a judge
advocate general.
Exactly. So he was the guy on NCIS or whatever, prosecuting the people. And he thought that the state's case, meaning the government's case, was weak. Now, that defies common wisdom multiple ways, because you expected the military guy to be a grunt. You don't expect him to be a lawyer. And then if you've got a prosecutor on your jury and you're a defense attorney, you don't want that guy on there for a million reasons. And yet that was the foreman, and yet that was the person who was the one against 11 who convinced – it was the shepherd – convinced that jury to find for the defendant in that case, because the prosecution simply hadn't proven their case.
Do you think not asking that juror a question amounts to some sort of malpractice? I mean, no. That to me, it's just sitting here saying, well, what did you do in the military? It seems like such a like
– No, no. Malpractice is a pretty high standard. And there's a lot of reasons that you do or don't do things in court. There's questions that you decide not to answer or you not to ask. And that can be in the jury selection process. If the lawyer didn't show up for jury selection,
okay,
or if the lawyer was intoxicated, or if, you know, the lawyer failed to file a paper or something, and as a result, the defense was stricken, things like that, mm-hmm. certainly. But for small tactical blunders, no, I think that's just a... Sorry, client, you picked the wrong horse.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, don't know. That's just the wild card. And that's the fear and the risk you run going into trial in the first place, that there's all these unknowns, mm-hmm. the risk that you cannot control, and your client has to understand that.
Yep.
There's a million things that can go wrong and a million things that can go right, and you just don't know.
Yep.
Probably cheaper to just settle the thing. And
almost always.
Almost always. There you go. So that's how we'll wind it up.
Yep.
Right? It's always a good idea. Always be settling. I like that. Well... thanks for coming in today. I hope you, listen, I really enjoyored having this conversation because I haven't thought about these things in a long time. And to hear you, you know, it's sort of like sitting back in my law school days, listening to those professors who were like, talk about very interesting things and learning this, you know, it's very cool to be a lawyer, you know, different way of thinking and viewing the world and understanding how the system works. So thanks for that. Appreciate it. But if my audience wants to get a hold of you, say that someone has a need of a lawyer in Lake County,
yep.
how do we contact you?
Well, you can always Google me, Tim Johnston, Johnston. My law firm is Johnston, Tomei, Linsicky, and Goldberg, LLC. It's a mouthful.
Yeah.
So it's JTLG.com. JTLG.com. But if you Google me, Tim Johnston, attorney, I will show up, top of the results. And we represent individuals and small businesses, and I always give free initial consultations.
There you go. And all your contact information will be in the description of the podcast episode. So, you know, thanks for coming in today. And there's one last thing that I have to do, because I brought my daughter in here when I first started the show, and she sat down across from me and she said, Dad, when you end your podcast, here's what I want you to do. You have to have your guest look at the camera and say, stay calm and slay on.
Stay calm.
Oh, wait, hang on. There you go. Right? Do it like a lawyer, like you're going to. When judge, stay calm and slay on.
Stay calm and slay on.
That was the best one. Yeah, thank you. All right. Well, listen, thanks, Tim. I appreciate it. And bye, everybody.
That was fun.